Okay. We are starting the track B, tackling the variety problem in big data. Ken, I guess Ken is going to talk right now. Ken, you're on?
Okay. Thank you very much. It's really unfortunate that I couldn't be there with you. Circumstances prevented that. So I'll be talking today about the track D. And but let me begin by mentioning a little bit that I just finished being on the review panel for the BD2K that Philip Bourne talked about. And I came away with a lot of interesting new understanding about big data and the and its role. Now, I thought I'd mention a couple of things in the form of good news and bad news. The good news is that there's an enormous interest in data science. So that sounds great. The bad news is I see very little interest in data semantics. So that's kind of unfortunate. For example, degree programs are cropping up all over the place, including my own institution. And these programs tend to be very weak on any kind of semantics, including the one that we just created. Another example of good news is that within the review panel, certainly within BD2K, there was a lot of concern and interest in ontologies. Bad news, their idea of what an ontology is isn't quite what we might think of as an ontology. They have very narrow use cases and, in fact, usually just search. So from that point of view, ontologies are just little more than vocabularies, perhaps arranged in some weak taxonomy. And as a result, ontologies are frequently viewed as peripheral and not fundamental to the processes that they could serve. So let me then continue to slide two. We've already heard a lot about the potential of big data, so that shouldn't be new to any of you. Traditional techniques are inadequate, and the new techniques are much better, but the variety problem is typically handled with ad hoc techniques. And with the emergence of big data, which actually emerged quite a long time ago, over 30 years ago, there was this transition from information scarcity to information abundance. This is slide three. And we find that organizations have difficulty coping with this transition. So moving on to slide four, the characteristics of big data that are generally understood today are that it consists of either large amounts of data or a rapid pace of data acquisition, that's velocity of slide four, or complexity of the data, which is called variety, or a combination of more than one of these. So I'm going to focus mainly on the variety problem, dealing with things like complexity of individual data item, whether you have both either structured or unstructured data and the complexity that that brings in, complexity of different data sources, and complexity even of data within a single source. So variety is actually a big subject. It's kind of unfortunate that, as I mentioned before, these new degree programs that are coming out like crazy today in big data emphasize volume and velocity and pay lip service to variety and really don't deal with it much at all. So going to slide five, the technology for big data is emerging that, 20 years ago it was MapReduce. Techniques for handling variety are also emerging, particularly in our community. Problem is there's really very little connection between these two. And what I'm going to try to talk about today are different use cases for how these two communities could perhaps collaborate much better. Slide six, I listed there the session speakers. We had quite a wonderful collection of speakers in Track D. Eric Chan, Nathan Wilson, Ruth Jur, Mark Fox, Malcolm Chisholm, and Dan Brickley, Rosario Seda Sosa. And slide 7, let me go into more detail about a couple of the speakers. Eric Chan from Oracle talked about tool development, addressing many aspects of the variety problem, including important aspects such as provenance, metadata, hypothesis generation, and workflow processes. So that was Eric. Then Dan Brickley from Google talked about the variety problem on the web, which is an enormous resource with tremendous variety, and gave some overview of the lessons learned from schema.org for open link data. Then on slide 8, we had Malcolm Chisholm, who talked about data governance, which we've also heard in the Track A presentation. Malcolm Chisholm discussed what was involved in data governance and its implications for managing variety in big data. Then Ruth Durer had a very interesting talk about the National Snow and Ice Data Center. Her talk was particularly interesting because of it brought out a number of different use cases for how how our community and the big data community could successfully forge collaborations. So moving to slide 9, Nathan Wilson spoke about experiences with using semantic technology in a particularly messy ontology, the Tree of Life. This is species, genera, and various taxa that classify all life. And it's had some very interesting examples there of use cases. Mark Fox and Rosario Luceda Sosa from Toronto and IBM, respectively, both talked about different aspects of city data, which is yet another example of really messy data from a large variety of sources and how one can reconcile the kinds of data you get from all of these sources. So moving on to slide 10. So why would semantics be important? Well, the truth is that misunderstanding the data can result in invalid or misrepresented analyses. Actually, we heard about Philip Horn mention this as well. There are a number of papers that have come out that have basically claimed that most public research findings are not just unreproducible, they're actually false, and that there are many forms of bias that can invalidate the results. Perhaps the results might be valid but just misunderstood, in many cases might actually simply be false. The fact is bias and observer effects are very difficult to recognize, especially if you don't have a really complete understanding of your data. And standard experimental procedures do not always eliminate bias. So these have been around for a while. These have been long recognized problems in the scientific research enterprise and presumably in any enterprise that involves the use of statistics, which is increasingly involving a lot of communities. The question is, could big data help or exacerbate this problem? It's not clear. Some people think it will help. Other people are not so clear. It could actually make things much, much worse. We'll see. On slide 11, so what could ontologies do to help with this? Well, in our track, we tried to find a number of possibilities, such as background knowledge, data structure itself, annotation of the data. A big area is provenance of the data, just how was the data created, how would you reproduce the data if you needed to. That's an enormous area, very little dealt with in many of the projects that I'm aware of, and certainly not much dealt with in many of these new degree programs in data science. And there are also privacy concerns that are also a big issue, very, very big issue in biology and medicine, but in general, it's a big concern. Slide number 12, there's still other opportunities that we can have for helping, which is data governance, integration, and quite a variety of techniques that Dan Brickley mentioned in his work. So now I'd like to switch somewhat to talking about the use cases that we try to identify. Try to abstract, perhaps not, I wouldn't go so far as to call these best practices, but rather more advice for how we as a community could find ways of better communicating with other communities, particularly the big data community, but other, there's still many other communities that are involved in data today. So the first one, slide 13, is a use case I called Harvest from Data Partners. So the idea is rather than build it yourself, make use of collaborators. So you harvest data and, ontologies from various sources, from sources that you collaborate with. It's still a lot of work because you have to convert, formalize the input, integrate the sources. It's not easy, but the result can be very high quality, and it has a huge bonus. It has a built-in user community, since the user communities that you are harvesting from become basically your user base. So that's a good example of how one can seek to get a constituency by basically harvesting what they already have. Nathan Wilson gave an example of a trait bank that came from a number of communities associated with the Tree of Life and the Encyclopedia of Life community. The idea there was to take the taxonomy that we have in the Tree of Life and to enhance it with traits, with properties, so that it becomes more ontological. And he did that by not by just inventing these things on his own, but by actually harvesting them from the various communities. Mark Fox and Osaria Uceda Sosa gave examples of harvesting data and metadata from city data sources. And these are, again, very complicated sources. They're very individual sources might actually be small, but the same kinds of data will be available for many cities, and it can be very complicated to integrate them because of the very different assumptions that they make. But again, the advantage is that you now have quite a large community of individuals that would be very interested in what you've harvested. Ruth Durer gave a very interesting example from the indigenous native communities in the Arctic region of how you can involve these communities and in an ontology development effort. And of course there's the web as a whole, which I didn't put on this slide, but it's Dan Brickley's work can be regarded as the schema.org that Dan Brickley talked about represents millions of providers and is just an amazing integration of a huge, huge collection of data partners. So then moving on to slide 14, here's another use case which is actually been talked about in other tracks of the modular development. The idea is that it's easier to reuse a smaller ontology and then larger ontologies and then to combine several of them to create an ontology that satisfies most of your requirements. So this is really part of the Track A theme. And it was satisfying to see examples of this. Ruth Durer in particular used this technique to develop an ontology for sea ice from several other ontologies. But there are many other examples. Now, moving on to slide 15, Interesting. This is an interesting use case where there are many models that are out there, often have been around for quite a long time. What we should regard as ontologies, and we could provide a valuable service by basically formalizing those existing models. And then once they're formalized, you can then use this formalization to build tools based on these models. Eric Chan gave an example where he formalized the OODA loop and then extended this and generalized it. The OODA loop came from a surprising source. It came from the military. People were interested in the military in how fighter pilots process information. And they basically came up with this, what is essentially just an informal model for the decision-making process called the OODA loop. And it's since been found that this OODA loop is used in a very large variety of decision-making processes, including the scientific enterprise, where hypothesis generation and testing is an important process in science. Another example of this formalization was Ruth Dürer, who presented a formalization of existing techniques for describing sea ice conditions and indigenous knowledge about sea ice. So there was a large amount of this kind of informal knowledge that was built up over many centuries, millennia even, by the indigenous communities, and it's withstood the test of time, clearly, and it would seem appropriate to formalize that rather than to try to invent an ontology from scratch. The city data is yet another example where you take existing informal data models for city data and then you formalize them. And these are some interesting models because they involve axioms and rule bases, and they have immediate benefits for interoperability among the different sources of data in the various cities. The problem there is that you often have very simple data structures, columnar data usually, with little metadata available for it. And you have concepts. The example that Mark Fox presented was student-faculty ratio. Now, you would think student-faculty ratio would be something that would be generally agreed upon, but he found that it's the opposite. Even though everyone refers to it by the same name, student-faculty ratio, there's little commonality in what it actually means. So if one city reports a student-faculty ratio in their public schools, it might have little connection or little relationship to what another city might use for what they call exactly the same thing. And so trying to compare these two cities with respect to student-faculty ratio is hopeless if you have no commonality. Rules and axioms can make a great deal of difference in terms of making this interoperable and making this data just understandable. So what you're talking about. Moving on to slide 16. I just mentioned Eric Chan's talk there, but actually there's many other examples of this. One way to develop your ontology is to make it more of a framework rather than a complete ontology, and you include extension points within your framework so that you make it easier to reuse your ontology. So you basically plan to have it be reused. Eric and his colleagues developed this framework for observation and decision making that he called CARE. And in this framework, he identified different kind of points where you could insert your ontology. So it's more of a skeleton for an ontology rather than a full ontology. You identify different kinds of data, different kinds of knowledge, and propose that you would insert into his framework your ontology according to the purpose and the role that it plays within the process of observation and decision making. Malcolm Chisholm was another one who mentioned an example of this kind of thing, where he talked about governance and how we need a framework for data quality. So that's yet another example of building a building with extension points. Dan Brickley also had a vocabulary pipeline that he mentioned in his talk about how one could take other vocabularies, other ontologies, and insert them into the schema.org framework via extension points. So that's another example how reuse could be facilitated using this kind of use case. Moving on to slide 17. This is kind of related to others. It's important to involve communities in the in your ontology. They're the ones who are going to be the users, and so you would really like to have them be involved as early as possible. And it's important that they be involved even if they do not necessarily contribute to the ontology. So Ruth Durer, of course, had an example where different communities were contributing, as well as communities that were just involved and were the users then ultimately of these of the ontology that was being developed for CIs. Yet another example, of course, in a much larger scale, is was Dan Brickley's talk when he spoke about involving all the various communities and companies that are involved with developing tools and content for the web. So that's another example where we should definitely involve communities in these efforts. Moving on to slide 18, the governance framework. This use case is one where we use relatively deep inference involving axioms and rules to ensure data quality. One of the examples of this was the OOR initiative from Ontology Summit 2008, so 6 years ago now, emphasized as one aspect of it the governance and business rules for ensuring quality of ontologies. Another example, of course, is the Malcolm Chisholm talk, where he explicitly discussed the important characteristics of governance frameworks for ontologies. Slide 19, I call this use case bridge axioms. One can use bridge axioms both at the data and metadata levels to bridge the gap between the semantics of data from different sources. This is, of course, the what InterIOP is all about. In the talks by Mark Fox and Rosario Seda Sosa, they discuss how they use this kind of technique in their work on smart cities. Nathan Wilson. Nathan Wilson also had some interesting aspects of this. He found that in an ontology, especially ontologies that have occurred in biology, the terminology. Okay, so the taxonomy, the ontology, actually varies over time. That's within the same we're talking about within the same ontology. There's a, you understand the world differently over time. So this can lead to a problem because literature and data from earlier times use the older terminology. So the only way you can understand this data from perhaps even a few years back is to have some kind of bridge axiom or rules that allow you to relate the terminology of the past with the terminology of the present. So it's an issue not just between different sources, but in fact within the same ontology to deal with this bridging problem. Now on slide 20, I just mentioned a number of other use cases. I actually already talked about vocabulary pipeline within the context of ontology development with extension points. But you could regard that as being a use case on its own, how one has a definite workflow pipeline for incorporating vocabularies. And pattern matching is another one. This is the terminology can be complex, as we see. There may be different ways of saying the same thing, and it would be good to map those different ways to the same URI. But as Nathan Wilson's pointed out, there can also be very different meanings for the same name. So it would be a little bit risky to fasten on, say, just one URI for a species only to discover that you're really talking about two different species. And suddenly the links to that URI, if not really being broken, are semantically broken, since any link that refers to these two species using a single URI is no longer meaningful. It's no longer the case that it's a single species. So so one has to be concerned, in effect, about versions of ontologies and therefore versioning of such resource names. Then finally, there was information ecosystem that was mentioned by Seda Sosa. The idea is to have a whole ecosystem of tools, techniques, and concepts throughout the entire data processing enterprise. And that was also something that was brought up by Philip Bourne, who envisioned this sort of information ecosystem for the biomedical research and education communities. So it seems like this is something that should also be addressed, and that the ontology community certainly can be a good part of this, an important part of it, actually. Then slide 21, there are many challenges, of course. As I've already said, there's little collaboration now between the communities, but I have suggested a number of use cases for how we can hopefully start to deal with this problem and improve the level of collaboration. The unfortunate focus on volume and velocity by big data and data science in general, with the assumption that somebody else is going to handle variety, that's not our problem. There's, of course, this big issue that Philip Bourne also mentioned, which is tool incompatibility. You tend to have so many silos, ways of doing things, but there is no ecosystem that allows all of these to be used in a compatible, interoperable way. The last one was mentioned. We didn't actually deal too much with this in the in our track. Was the hybrid reasoning gap perhaps in a later, in some later track or a summit, we can come back to this. Then the last slide is just some references. So thank you very much, and perhaps we can have some questions.
Okay. We have about 5 to 10 minutes, depending on how long you want. Any questions here? Yeah. Todd.
Ken, I posted the question on the chat room, but I'll ask it again. It occurred to me when we're talking about provenance, and this also relates to what Philip Bourne was talking about in terms of his research object, in terms of trying to, say, describe where data came from, and the situation I have in mind is some of the detectors that they have at CERN for their particle experiments, in trying to describe to some other user where this data came from, how much detail do you really have to go into? And more specifically in the context of ontologies, how much of that domain knowledge of how the data is created may be necessary to provide the appropriate, what we're calling provenance, to allow the reuse of that data, or even the discovery thereof?
Well, generally speaking, the more the better, I suppose, but the purpose of the data can certainly be very important for discovering it, for finding it, of course. I mean, without some idea of why it was created, why would you even look at it? So that's pretty essential. And of course, understanding how it was created is also very important for things like being able to use the data even. It's a subtle thing. I mean, at the kind of informally at the review panel, I was talking to someone about the image processing, and I think people might naively think that when you have a camera, some sort of, all it's doing basically is recording the raw data from the from whatever you're looking at, right? Each pixel is just whatever photons you've got from that particular place in the image. That's absolutely not true. These cameras actually do a lot of processing on the data, and very often that processing is proprietary. And so you really sometimes don't know actually what kind of processing went on in something as simple as just the pixel in an image. And if you then subsequently wish to do some processing with that image or to use that image with other images, also presumably of the same thing, lacking this knowledge of how that data was processed might make anything you do with that data problematic at best and perhaps completely wrong at worst. Okay, does that help a little, Todd?
Sort of. That then leaves open the question of how much effort you're going to go into to describe how the data was created. So the example you gave is perfect, because you can also talk about the technology of the sensor that was used and the way they do masking of different frequency bands and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So I guess I would suspect the same scenario occurs in many other natural science experiments where the mechanism that you're using or the mechanisms and how they were implemented and the time of day, the air pressure, all could become critical if your use of the data is very sensitive or very needs to be very specific. So I guess then the question for the research community is how much extra work do you want to do?
Well, it may not be necessary to do a lot of extra work if the tools that were available took care of providing this already.
You mean tools that you're using in your experiments in the first place? If they were self-explanatory?
If the tools already provided this, I mean, when you take a picture, you don't have to then proceed to spend a great deal of time analyzing what it was that you did to the picture.
Maybe you can take it offline a little bit here in terms of interest.
The camera should already do this for you.
Yeah, so any other questions here? Go ahead.
More questions?
Beth to Julian from Booz Allen. I had a question. I'm looking for best practices for versioning. You talk about versioning. I have some needs for pulling together an ontology from other ontologies, and that's an issue for me, is a term can change in one and not the other, and I need to follow that. Do you have any examples of best practices for versioning? Anybody?
It's a good question, and I guess
that is indeed, yeah, a really good
question. I mean, there's a lot of work done in the databases on versioning and things like that, so
right,
maybe you can
right.
get some.
There is some in the database community. There's theoretical work that exists for this. The modularity work also deals with the versioning issues. So there are a number of sources for how one can deal with versioning, but I don't know that there's a single real good understanding of how one should deal with it.
In fact, if you go back about 20 years ago on the object-oriented database development, mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of work done on versioning, like Stan Zdenek at Brown University and folks like that. They've published a number of papers.
Mm-hmm.